When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 2, Episode 4, Where the Stars Are Scattered Thinly. Aaron, if I said to you where the stars are scattered thinly, what would you say to me?
I would say, why the clouds are shining bright. I forgot the counter
sign. I'd have to shoot you. Yeah.
Yeah, with the clearly you're not in contact. Honestly, it wouldn't be the worst thing. what did you think of this episode?
Oh, I liked it. We get to find out a little bit more about the nature of the Prime Radiant, which I thought was super interesting. And seeing Harry, especially this vault's version of Harry, I think is always exciting because he's always got a new revelation, a new wrinkle in the plan. This freaking flim-flam artist, man, he's going to get a reputation if he's not careful for just straight up lying to you. But maybe that's what he wants.
It's
true. All part of the plan. I don't know. But I really love those parts of it. And then we've got, you know, the whole continuing conspiracy within Empire, which I'm excited to see more of. How about you?
Yeah. The politicking, the marriage alliance politics. This gives me a lot of like season, 2, 3, and 4 vibes from Game of Thrones, where you had the Tyrells come into town. They're going to marry Margaery to Joffrey, but they're looking to see what kind of dirt's got under the fingernails of everybody. It's
totally.
It's pretty good. Pretty good. And I'm still like, am I crazy or am I like more suspicious of the Sarah in this episode than I was before? She started to seem more and more like the type of person who might have engineered all this for the long haul.
Yeah, now she's, you know, she's not just meeting officially and being kind of coy and inquisitive in official meetings. Now she's back channeling stuff, and that's even more dangerous. Right now she's obviously actively manipulating the young Dawn. Dangerous stuff.
Especially when we know that Rue, who was a Gossamer Court courtesan, who was a lover of Dusk, who was, I guess, Day at the time, they have an ability. Dominion does. They have an ability to undo Imperial mental wipes and reconditioning. That's interesting. Like, what the hell did she take away, or were they able to recover from the session she had with Dusk that, might have altered the course of their history? I wonder if Dusk confessed about the genetic instability or something like that.
Could be. I think those are going to be very important recordings, whatever we get from that.
Continue to really like hope. I guess it's like set out to watch the first 4 episodes, and I'm like, I'm really looking for something to hook me this season. And I really, really gravitated toward the Hober Mallow guy. I really like Brother Constant. I don't know that I can explain their relationship, but I liked it. This very different Harry Seldon, who's not the raving lunatic from, that's hanging out with Gale, who's polished and in control and the plan is still, moving smoothly and correctly. And his like subtle digs at the administrator he doesn't care much for. That's built a mountain for himself to stand on and looks good in a fine suit. I like the two separate sides of Seldon here, and I'm wondering even more, like, what's it going to be like now that one of them is back to be imprisoned in the flesh?
It's all very exciting. There's an image that we're going to have to talk about that we talked about in last week's feedback section that I think is going to be I don't know. I don't know if it's supposed to be the most intriguing thing they've done yet with the show, or something that means that should be just obvious. But we'll talk about it.
Yeah,
because it shows up here again. But maybe we should get into the recap.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the whole Bel Rio situation. We better get into it.
And I have a billion notes, so let's do it. We start off with Polly and Constant arriving back at Terminus with their guest in tow, Hober Mallow. He and Constant talk about his history with religion, Locri wine, and her real name, which she won't reveal. And then the director greets them when they get down to Terminus, and they just kind of follow him. There's a voiceover at the beginning of this, which I think is Gale saying, if your parents never met, you wouldn't exist. If your grandparents never met, you wouldn't exist, whatever. Everyone's a result of the unique set of parents, and psychohistory doesn't care about them at all. And it kind of sets the stage for what I think is the very, very quick relationship that's developing here between Constant and Hober, which I'm not sure how I'm supposed to interpret what Gale is saying here. There's an element where you could look at it with a straight face and say, well, yeah, psychohistory doesn't need to care about them because they're insignificant, which is what she's saying. Or you could say that Gale is saying something here that is evidently false, because the pairing of these two would have created something amazing or horrible, and it's only by chance that we miss that pairing. I have so many questions about, you know, how should I read these voiceovers in this episode?
Yeah, because thematically they're trying, like, this is an episode that is about love and relationships. You know, it's like it's essentially three different couples.
Yeah.
And yet the book ending and the two book ending statements from Gale is that love doesn't matter. Like, it only matters to the individual, and psychohistory makes that attraction irrelevant on the scale of human. So it's like,
but is that a flaw or a strength of psychohistory? Is what is she trying to say with that statement? Right. Because it's true, or, but is it good?
Is it even a contradiction? Is it even a paradox? Because it could be something that, like, us humans don't want to believe. Like, our love is meaningless on galactic time frames. Like, we want to, you know, you hear this, like, oh, you had a love for the ages. Well, if that's, we want to believe that, it might not be true, though. You know, that, like, these, so, but I don't know, because, like, the show's official shtick is that psychohistory, you know, predicts group humanity behavior. So individuals, it doesn't matter if any one particular combination of genes comes forward. It's like they're going to be the cog that plays their part. And if it's not them, it'll be somebody else. Yeah. And I think that this feels like, you know, and we got in this little last year that this is kind of a repudiation of great man history. Because, like, up until the last 30, 40 years, or I guess until you had, like, you know, Marxian dialectics to kind of interrogate history through, you had this great man theory that, like, Julius Caesar came onto the scene, and he remade Roman from a republic to an empire, you know?
Purely out of his own will, yeah.
Yeah, like, just sheer determination and his skill and talent, he remade the world in his image. And I think modern historians lean more to conditions were ripe for the Republic to fall and an empire to take its place. And if it hadn't been Julius Caesar casting the die, it'd have been somebody else, either sooner or later. And that, I think, makes a hell of a lot more sense than, like, oh my God, you could have had the fall of the Russian Tsar, but Vladimir Lenin wasn't there. He wasn't born yet. So we're just going to be serfs for another 30, 40, 50 years until the next time. It seems like, no, you had conditions that are ripe. And individuals, well, it's inevitable that someone will step forward. But then on the scale of love, literally none of that shit matters to the individual.
Right.
So, I don't know. Is it a paradox? Is it a contradiction? Is it something we just don't want to believe is true, that the things that are important to us don't matter to the universe? I could see either.
Yep. Same here. It's clear from the very beginning of this episode that there is something going on with Constant and Hober. The way she kind of ogles him when he's got his shirt off, the way she's, like, very flirtatious in the conversation. She wants that, for sure. I mean, if she wants that, she should get a look at Empire without his shirt. She'd lose her mind.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you'd throw that Hober.
Because Hober's just kind of average, but
So I think it's interesting. She's a very young, sheltered woman. Probably fairly conservative in terms of, like, not U.S. politics, but in terms of how she was raised. And she's a virgin. She lets us know. And there's something interesting about the self-possession that she's like, I want to climb this particular tree. Yes, that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like is, you know, obviously is denied. But I think it's really interesting. And it kind of disarms Hober, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah, he's not sure what to do about someone this forthright. And also, someone is pretty naive. Like, he's like, you know, mm-hmm. this is a man that doesn't think much about the moral impacts of decisions. But, like, Brother Constant here has got him like, oh, geez, I need to reflect a little bit, right?
Yeah, I think he says he prefers to be about 10th to bed here.
Yeah,
not,
yeah, right?
Not first.
Yeah, yeah. I'd rather be, like, 10th in line.
Yeah, and I assume that's not just for his own sexual benefit. It's also probably right. for his own... emotional benefit. He doesn't want to be that guy, right?
Yeah, he doesn't have the space or the right shape to maintain a relationship. It only hurts someone like Constant. But also, uh-huh. like, there's something, you know, that he might want to explore there. And she has some insight. Like, you know, he says that he's this, like, world-weary, you know, very cynical person. But she points out several times, like, there is elements of... optimism to him, that he's kept this mm-hmm. very rare vintage of wine, sunny wine, for 15 years, implying that he's either not had anything to celebrate or he's still waiting for something even better. The fact that he's described the planet as permanent sun, you know, as a permanent sunny side rather than a permanent dark side, I thought that was mm-hmm. that was cute.
Yeah, it is a glass half full versus half empty kind of thing. I'm curious what would be the big thing that he would open this wine for. I almost thought we'd see it at the end of this episode. Like, maybe, you know, he'd get sent on a mission by Harry and love it so much that he toasts himself with the wine, but no, he's still saving it.
Or he cracks it open for Constant.
I do think we will see him crack that open at some point, and I bet it's going to be with Constant. I would wager just about anything that this is not the last time they will see each other.
Chekhov's bottle of Lockery wine, huh?
Yeah, okay. It's got to be, right? You don't point something like that out and then not use it. Also, there's the name guessing thing he's doing with her, which I don't know her name, but she kind of gives a look when he says Agatish. That's the one that I think he might have accidentally stumbled on her name, but she's not.
Oh, you think he
anything.
Did actually? Because I was wondering. Because like I don't know. This is what a flirting 101. It's just like you're trying to talk to mm-hmm. a girl without a reason to talk to a girl. So you're just making up like, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. if I guess your name, you got to date me. Like, OK, fuck?
I don't know. There was something when he says Agatish that made me think it might be her real name. Then again, maybe not.
She also confirmed she's a thespian. Which is something that uh-huh. we were speculating about earlier episodes, and I don't know if they're still on the table if she's a descendant from, you know, Hugo and Salvor or not, but it seems they're still, I still go back to them drawing a pretty clear line between, you know, Hugo, and here you have this main character with these bright blue eyes, and then you've got the mule in the future with those same blue eyes. There's some kind of thespian connection there.
I would say there's no way she could be a Hugo Salvor descendant, right?
Because
Salvor went into stasis for 130 plus years, and she's still the age she is with no kids. So,
yeah,
that can't be right. But yeah, who is she? How is she related to the rest of them? So in the, I think it was the first episode or maybe the second, we have her come back to Terminus. And she's talking with somebody who I thought she had called Pater.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she uses Pater in a very different way in this sense. She says like something about her Pater is a group of people that don't reveal their true names. But then at the end of this episode, there is a character named Pater, credited as an actor. And it is the actor that we saw earlier.
She said her father
both?
Is a thespian, and for cultural reasons, they don't reveal their names. I don't think, yeah, but I do think she has two dads.
Okay.
I do think she's got two gay dads.
Okay. All right, that might make sense. I don't remember the exact context, the exact phrasing, but I was very confused by it.
Right, right. No, I because like she called that man who we were kind of like calling her like maybe uncle question mark Pater before. Now she referred to So like I think she's there's some kind of you know non-nuclear probably gay relationship with her dad's, which you know I guess. Huh. I'm still trying to make a way for Salvor to like have donated her embryo like Gail did, but I can't make it work.
Nah.
I can't make it work. Maybe maybe Hugo moved on with someone from the foundation after she got in the pod and left for 100 years.
Sure, I can see that. You know. I'm sure that's what she would have wanted for him, right?
She like a Jon Snow character from The Expanse where he was like the child of 10 different individuals for some kind of property rights.
Yeah,
they all donated their like fraction of their DNA so they could all he could all be a joint. So it's solve some kind of complicated land-based hereditary system that's a problem in the future. But yeah, she could be like that where she's or I don't know, maybe they got technology in the foundation where just dudes can get pregnant.
Sure.
Maybe one of her dad's a trans man. There's a myriad ways to square that circle.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to Sarith going without makeup as a psychological trick to get Dawn to open up to her. And they talk about Joyner Rue's prior relationship with Dusk as they walk to a secluded grove where she tells Dawn that she wasn't the one who hired the assassins, but she asks if Day had her family killed. Dawn says, no, of course not. She asks if he would be able to kill her family since he's the same person as Day. And he says, not yet, but I might age into the idea. We'll see. Finally, Dawn says he likes her, and she asks why they aren't the ones getting married. Seems pretty superficial manipulation here, but Dawn might
be effective.
Yeah, Dawn might be ripe for it. I don't know.
No, this to me, like if you're a Game of Thrones fan, this feels very Margaery Tommen. Like this boy is not have any way, any preparation for the things she's employing upon him. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem like.
Yeah. So, it doesn't seem like Day does, let alone Dawn.
The big flaw of the queen being in on her own family's assassination is the conversation she has with Enjoiner Rue doesn't make sense because I would think that Rue part of my theory is that something that Rue picked up on the Empire has set all this stuff off back when she was a courtesan and they've recovered her memory. But that doesn't make sense because like she's having this conversation with Rue where she's like, I just want to find the truth of what happened to my family.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
I mean, all that stuff would have happened much, much earlier, right? They say it's decades ago that she was.
That's what I'm saying.
Dust.
So I don't see how this could connect, but they have to if my theory is right. So, say my theory is probably bullshit.
Gotcha. It's possible.
I'm just saying, Sarith is such a smooth operator that, like, some of the stuff she says, where I was just the pretty empty-headed thing that didn't get no training for statesmanship or military math. Well, how the hell are you operating? How are you moving like this?
Mm-hmm.
No one taught you how to move. How are you moving like this? Because she's moving.
She's moving. I agree.
And Rue's got the full court press on Dusk. They're like, it seems like they're both isolating Day.
Yeah. I guess so. But she has to work on Day as well, right? Like she's working on Day, but her side channel here is Dawn. And it really it provides context for what we saw in the last episode where they're having, you know, their official meal. And she kind of showered Dawn with attention during that meal. And that was interesting. And I thought, oh, maybe she's taking a liking to him, you know, and this is all kind of straightforward and she'd rather be marrying him. But now it's pretty obviously revealed as all manipulation.
Yeah. Do you think? I mean, I guess that's what you said, you know, she has to play to Dawn Day too. I don't think she is. Like, you look at the way that they interact with Day, it's like deliberately provocative and putting him down. Whereas you look at how Rue interacts with Dusk and you look at how Sereth interacts with Dawn, and it's a completely different vibe. It's very much more ingratiating, flattering.
For sure, but that's just the way she plays Day. Because he's a different person.
Well, I just feel like it's maybe... It felt like they were trying to isolate Day, but it doesn't make sense from Rue's perspective, because if according to her, the coupling is kind of like one of the things... It's one of her brainchilds. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know why she would be complicit in a plan to, like, Rue, you know, or maybe they're trying to actually get married to Dawn instead.
It's possible.
You'd have a longer rule.
For sure, yeah.
You know, you have 30 more years of miles on the tires. Seems like it's a closer age range, too. But
yeah, I think so. I will say you get a sense of the scale. They start this scene with a big shot of the gardens and the palace, and we kind of swoop up there. And everything in the Empire is big, right? Like, the combs are big. They're grand. The ficuses in the garden, that ficus that he takes her to is just enormous. Everything here in the palace is just huge.
Huge ficus.
And then we move over to Dusk and Rue. He finds her admiring his art. They also do a walk and talk about their prior relationship and the budding new relationship between Sereth and Day. Sereth still doesn't approve of the relationship. And Dusk invites Rue to watch the recording of the sex that they had years ago, which she agrees to as long as she can keep the memories of it this time.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to do. I mean, the Empire is a collection of weird dudes anyway.
All things have a cycle. First the podcast, then the ad.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Math is never just numbers. This isn't just a podcast. We're back with more Foundation.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was interesting that this they always have these different characterizations of this different, and that this Dusk is like, you know, really into the art, that he picked it up while he, because like it seems like Dusk, like his job is to start chronicling things and start painting pictures. Dawn is all about learning how to be Day, and Day does all the work. But this this Dusk, when he was Day, was still painting, because like, why wait for it to be a chore?
Yeah, let me ask you this.
But I kept on wondering, like, is there like a little like a laissez-faire attitude? Is like the reason Day's got the predicaments he's got is because Dusk was essentially painting while the Empire burned?
I mean, yeah, they were losing, grabbing planets.
Yeah, they're losing all this territory. A lot of it had to happen under his watch, but he's painting. I thought that was interesting.
It's possible.
It's nothing you can really hang your hat on, but it's something I'm keeping my eye on.
Does Rue make a mistake here? I'm not sure if it checks out from a plot point, but what she says to him, you know, about his art, this conversation they're having about his art and how he loved this stuff even as Day, makes me think that, you know, she got her memory reversed after she came back from the palace, and she remembered that about him, and that is why she gave him the genuine Dominion pigments.
Ooh, that's...
Is she accidentally tipping her hand by giving that particular gift?
It's subtle, but I see where you're going with it. Yeah, I couldn't say for sure he's not.
And she could play it off as well. You know, I've heard of how much, you know, Brother Dusk likes to paint.
All the Dusk paint, and we've got the best and... chroma pixels in the galaxy. Yeah, yeah. It could be innocent, right? But it also could show her knowing a little bit more than she should.
Yeah.
Why would being fucked by the Emperor put you on the fast track for political life on your home planet?
I don't know. Especially with a memory wipe. She came home rich. I guess... they get paid.
Well, that makes sense. Like, if you came, like, if you, like, I could see you becoming a minor noble of a smaller planet because of the wealth you would get from Empire if you, you know, served them that way. I don't understand, like, why you would automatically be granted, like, super high acts. But I don't know. I don't know anything about the Gossamer Quartz. The Gossamer Quartz is, like, all the noble, like, do all the nobles of the galaxy donate their children there? Do they just round up the most attractive? Like, how is the Gossamer Court selected? Because if it's like you have to be a noble to be there in the first place, then maybe that, you know, the fact that the Emperor liked you enough to have sex with you, maybe is a little bit of a cachet. But it wasn't immediately clear why this would be such a big giant boon.
Mm-hmm. I agree. There's something else that's not immediately clear to me. And it is, what is this image of our solar system doing plastered all over the Imperial wall here? Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
Do you remember the sort of close up that ends this scene as they walk away from the art wall, that shows what I think is like a skinned man or something on maybe a throne? Uh-huh. Directly above his head is that eight planet, that eight dot.
Really? That we saw in Dimmer's repair kit.
Yes.
I think we're actually talking about something that's going to come up in feedback this episode, but interesting. Okay.
And I'm looking at it thinking, am I supposed to just... Is this telling me that all this takes place in our future and that, like, Earth was somehow an integral part of the development of an empire years and years and years and years ago, millennia ago?
I mean, I 100%
believe that. Or am I supposed
to
be questioning, what the hell does this mean?
I believe that. I do think this takes place in the Milky Way galaxy. I kind of think they established that, too. But maybe not. But
we'll talk about the
feedback. I always got the opinion that Earth was, like, mankind has been exploring the cosmos for so long that the Earth is seen as almost like an apocryphal thing. Like, oh, that's like saying the Garden of Eden, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, some people literally mean the Garden of Eden, but, like, you know, you can use it poetically to mean, like, you know, where all mankind came from, right? And I think that, like, at this point, the soul and Luna and Terra are kind of like that for the people. But I could be wrong about that, because again, these are like 30-year-old memories I'm sorting through.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I don't think they've mentioned it in the show yet. So, but they keep dropping this image and I keep seeing it now.
We'll keep an eye on Solar Watch.
Then we go over to Bel Rios. His ship arrives at Savannah. Savannah? I don't know how you say it. Probably depends on who you are. They think the natives haven't detected them and decide to drop down to the planet to meet with their informant. When they get there, they need to go secure their extraction packet, but a group just claimed it as legitimate salvage. Bel offers to pay him for it, but it turns into a fight. He turns it into a fight, which Glaywin thinks he was a little too eager to get into, because they end up killing everyone except for a single guy who escapes, probably to return with others. So they grab the extraction packet and race off towards their informant.
Yeah, what'd you think of the drop pod insertion sequence?
It's cool for a lot of reasons. Here's what I would have preferred. I would have preferred some kind of acknowledgement that there's an atmosphere around this planet, that they don't just drop in all fine. Like, maybe, you know, give the drop pods the same kind of aura stuff that Emperor has, so they can drop through an atmosphere unharmed. But here they don't even heat up, right? They're just like down, no problem.
So here's the thing. I've taken it on a matter of faith that the only reason that, or a matter of science, the only reason that aircraft heat up entering Earth's atmosphere is because they're moving at a terrific velocity compared to it. If we had anti-gravity technology to where you could take a geostationary orbit, you could drop something from that ship. Slowly. It would go straight down and it'd go at terminal velocity, but I don't think that's enough to like burn up.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Because I don't think they orbit like the way the space shuttle does, where it's going like so fast that it's essentially
20,000 miles an hour.
I think they just like orbit, like they just kind of hover. But you could be right. You could be right.
No, that makes sense. The other thing that I noted on this is where they land. The landscape here is really weird. It's bizarre and interesting. It's got a lot of divots in it, just a ton of divots, and they're all kind of lined with stones. They're
terraced, yeah, like it's some kind of agricultural technique of this weird planet.
Yeah, I'm thinking, is this a farm? Is this a graveyard? Are these like grave markers around these things? And these divots are where bodies are buried? Is this like a previous Imperial fleet landed here with thousands of troops and they
these
created
like
the divots decades ago?
Holes?
Yeah. Yeah. How did this landscape get created and what's its purpose?
And we'll never know.
We'll never
That's
know.
That's the funny thing. It's like they do all this stuff and make it look so cool and weird and alien, but we'll never know. Because
this is a question I need to ask Goyer when we have him on.
Yeah, in your mind, what are those divots?
Yeah. They could be lightning strikes, but then I would think they would probably be glassed, like the sand would change its nature there. But I don't know.
Yeah, and the real thing is you're supposed to understand, you know, like Gaywin says, you don't want to let the Empire change you into some hair trigger psycho they can point at
you
anybody.
You can't call the man with a husband Gaywin. I won't let it stand. I'm sorry.
What
it's
is Glay. It? Again? What's his?
It's Glay.
What?
Glaywin. There's an L
with
in
an
there.
L.
Yeah.
Oh, because I was just going on the character guide.
I know. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Is that some kind of Welsh deal that they invent an L to put in?
Oh, I
thought it might be Gaywin, but Glaywin? Glay? Glaywin?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll go with Glaywin.
I mean, look. If Agatish is a valid name, then Glaywin is a valid name in this universe.
Weenus.
Oh, Jesus. We'll talk about Weenus. Where were you going with that? Sorry.
Oh, I just go into the next scene as far as I'm concerned. Just that, like, yeah, the whole point of that is, like, Glaywin is concerned that his husband is being turned by the Empire into a psychomaniac.
Right. And he says, you know, Empire takes a toll indeed, right? They've turned him into a violent man who's quick to anger.
And Bel knows it. He doesn't like being reminded of it. Makes him angry when you bring it up.
He does have a cool facial scar now, though.
I
assume.
Yeah.
He got slashed in the face. And they bust out more than one new tech on us here. They have these foldable guns, extendable guns.
Yeah, reminded me of like Idris Elba's like Deadshot equipment he had in the Suicide Squad, these transformable rifles.
Yeah. All right, next scene, everyone gathers around the vault as Hober Mallow is brought to it. They show him what happened to the warden, and he refuses to participate. But just then, he's sucked into the vault, and Constant and Polly go in after him. But the director stays behind like a coward, at least for now. How could you say no? Like, I don't know.
It's cowardice.
I'm going in. I'm so curious that I would have to go in that thing, especially after I see Constant go in and not burned alive doing
it. Yeah, your whole life you've been watching this thing and wondering when it's going to open, and hear about the last time it's open, and your whole purpose, and but he's just a coward. He's a coward. It's the only explanation. He's Kraven. Yella. Yeah.
I will say it's a little strange for Constant to think that Hober needs her help inside this vault. She's like, let's go help him. Why would he need help?
This is her hormones talking.
Yeah.
Needs help out of his pants.
Sure.
Is what I think you're supposed to understand here.
His reaction at seeing his name scrawled across, burned across this thing is like, is hell no.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah,
this guy's very
worthy of an engraved invitation. That is funny when they pan through the warden. It's just like a charcoal briquettes down there. That was a person?
Yep. So the vault is huge inside. They meet up with Hober, who says it's been 2 days since he went in, which is crazy. He's been wandering around that whole time, and the director joins them inside finally, and they start off in a direction. And eventually they hear music and follow it to Harry's office. And he appears and he's pleased to see that Foundation has entered the religious phase and tells them that he needs them all to prevent the war. And I'm going to kind of... I guess the episode stops there. I'm going to break up later scenes because there's a lot that happens in here.
Mm-hmm. So I think that I want to give props to the production design, because I think it's kind of amazing how many landscapes they got out of what is essentially a huge blank room that they just use shadow and light. Just light source to like suggest there's walls and flip, but there's nothing really there. It was such a really cool look. And then as they get closer to Harry, the space starts congealing into space. Like you see the repeating staircases that are a hallmark of the inside of like the prime, not Meridian.
Radiant.
It's the prime Radiant. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to say prime Meridian every fucking time. But like and then it starts turning into the geodesic triangles and shapes and tesseracts until you get to his office. I thought that was just a really simple and elegant way of suggesting these kind of like vast fictional spaces.
Yeah, it looks really cool. It is very slick, and I think it's also connecting things thematically, because there's some interesting stuff we learned about the Prime Radiant in a later scene here that I think is surprising and kind of they've been hinting at for a few episodes now.
What is the... Yeah, are you ready to talk about that? Because I'm not sure I'm picking up what you're putting down.
No, let's wait until we get to that scene.
Okay.
The other thing I think is funny about this scene is, you know, when Hober gets to Harry's office, for lack of a better term, and he starts eating and they're talking about, you know, that. So if this vault makes everything, then it comes from your body, right? And the pause that gives him as he's eating. But it's also another like Jesus illusion, right? Harry as Jesus, the eating of his body, right?
Take
they're
this,
intentionally
this means
doing
my body,
stuff.
Drink this means my blood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the Judas move of taking a dump inside your creator's coffin, I suppose, because he's been in there too.
Yeah.
He's in there for 2 days, Jim. What's he supposed to do? That's another interesting thing, the time dilation. That there was they say 2 minutes. I doubt it. It felt more like 30 seconds. But Hober's been in there for 2 days.
Yeah, and that was interesting because to Harry, it almost feels like very little time has passed, right? He says, Polly, so young, not so long ago or whatever. Just yesterday, I think. So young just yesterday.
And is that under control by Harry? Because I don't know, this could be just a mistake, but at the end, Hober leaves quite a while after their others leave the facility. And there's this hilarious scene where Constance tries to pull the, like, oh my God, it's been 3 years. And I was almost like, holy amazing. Shit, that might have been. But like, it should have been, I feel like it should have been like a month or two. But like, I wonder if Harry slowed down time just to like give Hober Mallow some cooling off, you know, that's give him some time to humble him a little bit, have him, you know, wandering through this alone, maybe feeling like he needs other people. Like it's a manipulation tactic that Harry's using, because it seems like, unless it's just a mistake, Harry has full control over how fast time elapses within the vault.
Yeah, I could see that being the case. It's interesting in context of everything we've heard Harry say about the vault, and how, you know, it could drive you mad spending an amount of time in there. Is that because the time you spend in there, if you spend 138 years in the vault, you've really spent millennia in the vault, based on how you'd feel about it? Time in the vault is dilated, or potentially it's variable in a way that's both, you know, extended and compressed. You know, it could be, because when he says you were so young just yesterday, it makes me feel like Harry has felt as if this time passed in the blink of an eye, right? This 138 years might have felt like a few days to him.
Yeah, and
whether he's in control
something.
Of that or not is up in the air, I guess.
He says, I've become unattached to physical needs and time, he hesitates, slips in here. So that could mean a lot of different things. But what ultimately it means, it has no relation to how fast time is elapsing on the outside.
Yeah, and potentially in both directions, right?
I like, again, this is, I talked about this in the last season too, like when Jared Harris is allowed to be like this, like, you know, kind of great man motivator, and he's doing and saying all the right things. Like, you can see how much it means to Polly to be recognized. You can see how much it means for Constant for the Prophet to lay his hands on her. You can see how prickly the director is about, you know, the things, like, for example, he says, I'm glad you all came. It's not just Hober. I need you all to prevent a war. And the director really doesn't like that. He is spoiling for a fight with Empire.
Yes. I mean, because he was told, well, he wasn't directly told, but they were told, the Foundation, that they needed to prepare for this war the last time Harry emerged. And now this dude who revealed that it was a lie in the first place and that they needed to prepare for war is revealing that the war was a lie too, and now they need to try and prevent it.
I wonder if it's another Christ,
that's gonna be annoying.
I wonder if it's another Christ metaphor, because, you know, the night of his death, Christ famously asked his disciples to go out and procure a few swords, because, you know, things might get rough later. Later in the Garden of Gethsemane, when they came to arrest Jesus, Peter goes and lops off one of the guy's ears, and Jesus puts a kibosh to it. It's like, whoa, what's all this sword play, Peter? Peter's like, the fuck, Lord, what? You put this in my hand in case things got rough. No, he doesn't say that, because, you know, that's not what you say to Jesus. But it's like, it's almost like someone setting up an object lesson for you to learn. Is that what Harry's doing? Like, he's having them prepare for war, but then at the last minute be like, but that's, you know, obviously we need to avoid this at all costs, and it's a test of his Foundation. I think that's an interesting concept.
It's possible. I wonder if there's a second layer here, because there's a second Harry. If he knows that the Harry that everyone's interacting with will come off as a liar and people will start to distrust him, because that's part of the plan, you know? Harry at some point needs to kill God. He needs to kill himself as a mythological being and let the Foundation flourish on its own and take its own path.
But how do we square this with him intentionally doing things to keep himself from being deified last season? Just wasn't the right time yet. He needed to, like, pump the brakes on the deification just a bit so that all the timings would hit perfectly. Yeah.
And now he's smiting people to make them to make him seem
time
like
for the religious. And he's like, and then what's going to come next? He leaves that for a mystery.
I like this. I like this a lot.
Have we actually got to that point yet? That's when he's having a conversation with Hober. Okay, I want to because I want to see. I want to talk to you a little bit about that when we get there.
All right, let's move on to Bell and Glaylin arriving at a cliffside home where they find Patrician Barr, their informant. He tells him he's been sending him information for 40 years, but no one's responded. They spot some real life books, which amazes them. And Barr shows them his recordings of Constant using one of the Imperial auras and their connection to the Foundation, the Vault, and the evidence for them having jump ship tech. This is all mind blowing to them.
Yeah. So it turns out we got some, because we got a little bit of the feedback's going to be a bit of dry pie about the old man theory being a spy for the Empire, because, yeah, this episode, he's a spy for the Empire. 100% right. What do you think about these religious? But these are like, it looked like they're Hindu texts, ancient Hindu texts.
Yeah, it's Vishnu, right? In the images here.
Yeah, and I looked. I did some. I thought I determined what text this was from, but I did. I forgot to write it down. But yeah, this debate about a prince and his charioteer. You know, they got amassing for a large war, but they debate the rationale for it.
I feel like he's describing them in this scene very distinctly based on the stuff, you know, where Glaywin's saying, like, look, you can't become this trigger happy maniac. They can't turn you into that.
Well, even their toast, right? It's like, here's to the ones who fight. And then Glaywin corrects it to also, and those ask why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like you see Glaywin like elbowing bell hooks, like, see. Remember when you were like a philosopher warrior, a warrior monk?
Right. And there's this weird relationship that Bell has to, I guess, the mark that he suffered under the Empire. It feels like he's gatekeeping a little here, because Barr says, you know, the Empire's yoke has left a mark both during and after their occupation.
Yeah.
And Bell scoffs at that. He's like, as if he's the only one who could possibly be marked by the Empire due to their misdeeds against him.
Well, it's an imperial. It's funny because it's like an imperial loyalist who's been done dirty by the Empire, just rejects him out of hand. That like these like, oh, but the Empire, like, you were better for, you know, like, it's no doubt in his mind that the Empire belongs here. The Empire is, you know, it's like Day's a little bit of a lunatic, but the idea of the Empire and hegemony is 100% right. I think that's what I got from that.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. That's what it's getting at. The other thing here is nobody paid attention. For 40 years, he's been beaming shit back to the Empire. This, I assume these are the rumors that Demerzel was talking about. Mm-hmm. They weren't rumors. He was getting this shit directly from one of their informants. Why are they not paying attention to it? They really took their eye off the ball.
It makes you think, like, is the Imperial switchboard just on fire all the time? So, like, weird magicians. Because that's the other thing. It's not like they're saying Harry Seldon's foundation is doing this. It's weird magicians. And, like, in all the galactic list of threats, did weird magicians ever make it into the top 10? Probably not. But also, it just goes to show how much the Empire has been slipping since we've caught up to them.
Mm-hmm. How does he get books way out here? Especially the seemingly Earth tales?
These, be tens of thousands of years old is what I got from it.
Yeah, I'm starting to put together we are, in fact, in some version of the timeline where Earth exists. This is not some strange galaxy.
Battlestar Galactica situation?
Yeah, seems like it. Because Vishnu is an Earth concept, so they wouldn't put that imagery in there without it meaning something.
Yeah, and it does seem like they are laying a lot of tracks for the Sol system and, you know, mankind's kind of origins pre-Trantor.
The other thing that's kind of happened here is Empire has tipped its hand here on Savannah to its presence, right? I mean, the people who confront them, who have their extraction packet earlier on, recognize them as carrying Imperial gear.
Yeah, there's the it was Retainer Rue points out they put their logo on everything. They can't help it.
They put their logo on Bell too, right?
True.
And that doesn't necessarily mean he's part of the Empire. He could, I mean, he didn't get that because he was in their favor. But like, they know that the Empire is out there sniffing around these worlds now. again, which is something that I think they didn't really want them to know.
Oh, you know what? This is all like, this is another, sometimes they work so subtly that I miss it. But like when he's talking about the Empire leaving a mark on everything, this reinforces the thing that Rue said. It reinforces the brand that we saw this guy got. Like it's you know, thematically tying together that, yeah, everything the Empire touches, it leaves its mark.
You can also tie it back to the larger, you know, themes of relationships and love that's happening, because it's left its mark on their relationship as well, on Bell and Glaywin's relationship.
Yeah, you get the idea that they were one of those fighting units where they just like communicated effortlessly and they always knew what the other was going to do. And Glaywin is shocked that, you know, Bell is this like, you know, spoiling for a fight.
It's, you know, he's changed.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Potential psycho.
So the locals show up demanding their heads, Bell and Glaywin and Barr. So they give Barr a merciful death and then make their way out the back and extract back up to the ship. And Glaywin gets to keep this book, which is interesting.
Yeah, apparently this guy was chiefing up some poison blunts.
Some needle weed, I'm going to call it, since it's needle tea. I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
He calls it something specific. Lichen or Larkin. I don't know what he says.
I like that. There's like those little grace mode of that old man. I really liked it when he's like, a particle beam to the head would be more dignified. And when Bell relents, he's like, oh, thank you. And he puts his head. I thought that was like a nice little, you know, like, I don't know what dying of needleweed is like, but apparently it's it must be worse than lights out.
Yeah. Seems like it. Probably, I don't know, die vomiting or bleeding from every orifice. I don't know. It's probably horrible.
Uh-oh. Our dynastic empire is experiencing some genetic drift. We'll be right back. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. The algorithm says the podcast will continue. Welcome back to Foundation.
Anyway, inside the vault, Harry serves drinks. Polly spots the Prime Radiant and asks how it's here because he thought it left with Salvor. Apparently, it's a quantum computer that exists in two places at once. Constant steers the conversation back to preventing the war, and Harry tells her and Polly that he wants them to go to Trantor to open diplomatic relations. And he opens an exit for them and invites Hober to stay for a while. But before he leaves, Polly asks Harry why he killed the warden, and he says basically it was to appear godly to the Foundation.
And to maybe prune someone that's a little too serious about it.
Uh-huh.
How long would it have been until he's saying he's the only one that's approaches the conduit? And see, sometimes you gotta smite a motherfucker.
Yeah, I guess he doesn't want prophets, huh? Mm-hmm. He just wants to be God directly. So here's the stuff that I was talking about earlier.
Before we get to that,
okay,
I cannot wait to see what it looks like for Polly and Constant to go before the Empire to preach the word of Harry Seldon.
Right.
Just as they're being sent there, just as Empire is fully realizing the hood that's been winked on them.
Does Empire have an equivalent of Titan's prick? Because that's what I expect.
Dude, it feels like Harry is provoking a war, because it seems like what's going to happen is these guys are going to be slaughtered and executed publicly, and it's going to inflame the Foundation and galvanize
martyrs.
Them.
Yeah.
But that would mean that Harry's lying to these people, but that would mean it's Tuesday. So it seems like that's what's actually happening. I would be shocked if anything else comes of it. And that's sad, because maybe they killed Polly, but not Constant. Because Constant feels like she's built for the long haul on this show.
I agree.
I would be outraged if she dies next episode, because I feel like I'm just getting to know a very interesting person.
Mm-hmm. I assume she's going to get away somehow. And yeah, it makes a lot of sense that Polly would be a sacrifice,
especially since there's also do you think Harry knows what the Empire knows? Because it's also funny that he's telling them not to take their jump ships because they don't want to let too much out of the bag. But is that
when
just
we've
like
already seen that they've let it out of the bag, right? They were recorded using them. So
is that an instance of is this the kind of drift that we see that Gale sees that the Prime Radiant is undergoing, that maybe this version of Harry doesn't see? Or is it Harry being like one step ahead of the manipulation curve?
Could also be that. I wouldn't put it past him. Mm-hmm. But there is this connection between the two Harrys that I wanted to talk about.
All right, let's talk about the quantum superposition.
Yes, quantum entanglement stuff that's happening with the Prime Radiant. They're quantumly connected as quantum supercomputers. There was something that happened with Harry when he first... I think when he first came out of the Prime Radiant into the ship that Salvor and Gale were on, where he confuses himself for a moment. He's like, I was in the vault. What happened? And he thinks he's still that Harry. Yeah. I think this is a literal, like, he is that Harry for a moment. That there is a physical universe connection to the two Harrys that is real. It's not just, he was confused because his brain is broken.
Does that mean that every time Harry is conscious in the vault, that the one that's on the, you know, with Gale and Salvor has to stop working?
We don't see him. We don't see the second Harry, right? I don't know.
We don't see the second Harry this
episode. Yeah.
Is that why he had to become a human? Because that was going to become a problem.
Oh, maybe.
So now, like, has the superposition been solved? And that, like, one is now the digital Harry and one is now the physical Harry?
Yeah, they've separated them. Yeah, why would that be important? So that the Harry in the vault can't gain some kind of access to the knowledge of the second Foundation?
I don't know. Because, like, I was even thinking, like, what is a superpositional quantum, you know, the Prime Radiant even do for us in the plot?
Just allow you to have a second
copy of something that could be here because something could... I don't know.
It could be a Band-Aid on that, but it feels more important than that to me.
No, it doesn't feel like they're building to something with this duality, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't see it yet. just can't see it yet.
Same here. Yeah.
I thought you had a bigger piece of a theory when you're talking about like.
Oh, no, I don't. I have not connected at all.
All right. Well, I
have not
hope.
Come up with the grand unifying theory yet. Scientists are still working on it.
I haven't decoded psychohistory yet.
No. So then the other thing about this scene is Harry really praising the religious members of Foundation. And we're going to see kind of why later when he's in the next part of the scene. But he's really just patronizing the director here, right? With his suit comments and
again, fine suit.
And the thing that he's doing here is he's having the Foundation use the religious arm to actually go out and accomplish things, whereas the governmental arm, the tech that they've evolved, he's specifically telling them not to use it. Because the jump ships were all developed, you know, under the directors.
Right. You can see.
Well, under that branch of the Foundation.
Yeah, and you can see the director probably wanted to have a big show of force, like jump in the Trantor. Uh-huh. Like, we got jump ships. We can do this. We can do that. And Harry's like, no. And he's chafing under that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like the naked joy that was on Polly's face when he realizes he's going to be able to, not a flim flam man, not a confidence man, not a, you know, guy peddling hokey, but he gets to be an agent of peace.
Yeah. You he's know, got a like, purpose like, now.
Yeah. Something that he like, is this the type of thing he can do without having to drink himself into a stupor?
And at the end of the scene, he decides I don't need the drink. Right. And he walks, he puts that down, he walks out, and he gives one last look back at Harry, because I think this is the last time that Polly's going to see Harry.
That's what I got, that like, oh my God, I was the last, and now I'm amongst the first, and it's the last. It's like, yeah, he's soaking it in.
Yeah. Yeah. He's reflecting on his entire life, and it's all been worth it now, right?
Yeah, what a fucking bookend, man.
Right? So let's go to the second part of this scene where Harry tells Hober that he called him here because he has influence and he's sending him on a mission that is counter to the mission of peace that he just sent Polly and Constant on, but we don't know where he's sending him yet. And he talks about, you know, the next stage, I guess, for Foundation, which is this religion phase. It's a developmental stage all civilizations go through. Some never escape it. That strikes me as true. In civilizations that are not in contact or not branches of other existing civilizations, like if you're an organism that's struggling to acquire knowledge and find answers, you're going to be wrong in your determinations a lot of the time. And you might attribute those things to gods and you might start to worship those sorts of things. But Foundation has the benefit of having spawned off a civilization that has already worked all that stuff out. And I'm not sure that it would work quite the same. This Petri dish is a little contaminated, is what I would say.
Yes. The only question I have is the contamination accounted for?
Yeah.
You know, does Harry know, like, does he have a protocol above this? Uh-huh. What did you make
and
of
it might be necessary for, like, the emotional buy-in of a group, right? You might need this mythos to really buy into the ideals of Foundation. That could become a religion, certainly.
What did you think he made of the a passing ghost dropped your name?
Is this the mathematician? Is this the other Harry? Is this... Yeah, I don't know. Those are possibilities.
When Gale came back from a vision of future, was the mule asking for Hober Mallow or was he asking for the Mentallics? Mm-hmm. Was he asking for Hober Mallow?
I believe so, yeah.
Because, like, is that what, when he's talking about Gale and a passing ghost, is he talking about his superpositional self gleaning information from this vision that is feeding back to the prime radiant?
It's kind of what I'm thinking. Yeah.
But like Harry doesn't have direct contact or some kind of like osmosal information exchange between the two.
Mm-hmm. It's possible.
Yeah, interesting. I got to say, though, with these counterposed purposes, with the intense connection that Hober and Constant feel towards each other and his glee at being used as a knife, you know, like a cat's paw, it does seem like it would suit this purpose well to have Constant be killed at the Emperor's hand to really galvanize Hober into action.
And fight
and be the one that's going to like, want to fight that war. Because, if the other mission is peace, a counterposed mission is war. I mean, that's all there is to it. It literally means in opposition to, because I've never heard counterposed. You know, I could have guessed what it meant, but it literally means like something posed is the opposite of something else. So, oof.
And the thing we didn't really talk about yet with the, the developmental stages of a civilization is Harry also mentions what comes after, which is, the religion is meant to be replaced by another mechanism, but he doesn't say what that mechanism is. I can't guess because I do remember where the first book goes with this.
I was going to ask you, do you have any memory of this? Because I lose track of what's in the first book, second book, third book. I know roughly the next shape things are going to go, but I was wondering if you did too.
I do. I can't say much. But I think aside from mildly interesting, I would also say think about how civilizations you're familiar with might develop.
Yeah, because again, this is all based on this is all based by Asimov on real history. So yeah.
And this stuff excites me. I like seeing the further developments, how Foundation is going to change to deal with the threat of Empire.
Yeah, this core of the books, the skeleton that it's built on, is in on its own fascinating. So getting to see another cog of that click over is going to be really cool.
And then Sarith meets with a member of Day's Guard.
Oh, before we move on, what did you make of the commonality that Harry was building with Hober? They both grew up with disapproving fathers, trying to put them on courses of action that was predetermined, that they rebelled against. Is there a part of Harry that's hoping that Hober zigs where he's supposed to zag, because here's another father figure saying, here's the path before you, son, walk it. But he starts a conversation saying, you and I both spat in our father's face and refute. Isn't that kind of interesting?
Yeah, it could be to ingratiate himself and make himself a friendly god, or it could be to say, I'm the guy setting you on this path, defy me.
So is he counterposed a mission to secretly homopose that's going to be juxtaposed? How many poses we got here, Selden?
I don't know. A lot of them.
It is. Last thing is he opens the prime radiant to show him where it's like where the blade will be thrust, but we don't see where. Keep that in mind when we discuss the scenes between Hober and Constant going forward.
I will say the one last thing I noted on just my modeling brain taking over in this scene, because I want a model of everything and the Prime Radiant would be super awesome.
That would be a great practical model.
Right? There's some real physical weight to this thing that I don't even know how you would duplicate in a physical model, because when he slides that across the table, that thing, either the table is made of sandpaper or this thing has a lot of weight.
It could be
heavy metal and resin,
chunk of glass or acrylic or
a solid chunk of glass would do it.
But what's the original filigree inside of it? Is it just a whole bunch of gold wire shaped and bent and posed and
It looks like gold to me.
They suspend it in a clear medium. The heart. I don't know. Yeah, it'd be. Adam Savage needs to get busy building. Doing a one day build of the Prime Radiant. He's got to watch the show, right? No fucking way is Adam Savage not watch the show.
Yeah. All right, let's move over to Sarith meeting with a member of Day's Guard, I believe, who says he can help them figure out if Day killed her family, and also to get her the visual records of the assassination attempt against Day. And here's where we learn Dominion has the ability to do several things with memory. They can block a memory wipe, they can reverse it after it's happened, and they can fool a memory audit. Can they do multiple things simultaneously? Can they reverse a memory wipe but also fool
an audit? You can only do one. The grooves of your brain can only be...
we gotta scoop out certain parts and...
Yeah. You know. It's like a... you know, a solid state drive. There's only so many times you can blow those fuses before it's just done.
Well, that's the thing, to fool a memory audit. I guess in which ways can they fool a memory audit? Can they make it seem as if the person didn't see the things they saw? Yes, that's evident, right, in this conversation. Can they make it seem as if the person did see things they didn't see?
Oh, that's interesting. And especially since Empire's putting so much stock and faith in their memory auditing.
Because like, what happens if they wipe this memory and they do an audit and there's just a blank? It's like Contact, right? There, hours of static or whatever it is.
Yeah.
What were you doing during the static? You weren't sleeping. You were on duty. What the hell, man?
Yeah.
So they got to replace that with something.
Is it interesting that she says, like, did Cleon 17 have a hand in the death of my family? Because, like, I'm kind of suspecting Dusk. And I wonder if this is a... they're going to be checking that's the one flaw she's making, is she's suspecting Day this whole time, and it was actually Dusk that did all this.
It could be. I mean, what's his incentive here, right? To make it so that she frames it as somebody arranged the death of her family in order to make it possible to have a marriage arrangement here, because nobody else in her family would have ever even considered it.
Maybe she's confusing the intended goal. Maybe it was just a weakened dominion for conquest so that Empire can just suddenly get bigger through an easy way. And
you got this radical Day out here.
And Day's trying to like share 50-50 of things. Like, it's like, why don't we just... Yeah, that's the only thing and the only way. Because like the other... If this is Day's idea all this long, or Dusk's rather, I don't understand why he's so unless this is a Harry Seldon game, manipulation game, I don't understand why he's so in opposition. But like, if he wanted to conquer Dominion instead of an ally with it, I could see him thinking, I did all this fucking exquisite political manipulation and you are just pissing on it. You are taking my intricate painting and drawing on it with crayon. You are,
and that might lead someone to try and kill you, right?
And you're the dumbest, most degenerate one of us too. You're the one that can't get your napkin folded correct.
Genetic drift. Yeah,
both of us hang slightly to the right, you're danging to the left. Come on. We got to get together. Yeah, I can see that's another way to look through his anger and frustration with Day, that Day is just cocking up something that's been a whole generation in the making.
I like it. And then you could extrapolate and say maybe Dusk, seeing that, would be angry enough to order a hit on Tay, right?
Right, right, yeah.
To preserve Empire, of course.
Yeah. I gotta say, this hand man that they've got is like where I want to be with my beard, my mustache, my body in the next 15 years. This dude is fucking... Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I like him. Impressive.
Okay. Where I don't want to be with my body is where the Day's guard is, because his face is all scarred up. What the
Dude,
hell?
Yeah, man.
Was that at the hands of Day, you think?
I was wondering, did he get that in the line of duty? Is that something that Empire did to him? Don't know.
Yeah, I wonder. Empire does leave a mark.
And this is the Imperial Guard. These are the most loyal... The inner circle. It's kind of nuts that they've got someone that they're able to... I mean, if you can get this close to the Empire, what can't you do?
Yeah. I wonder how they did it. And, you know, Sarith here wants to get the visual records of the assassination attempt so she can figure out how he survived an attack by...
What was the first alarm bell that went off when you heard that? Because I had one.
The first alarm bell?
Yeah.
I don't think alarm bells were going off for me.
No one knows that Dimmerzel's a robot. That is strictly guarded Imperial secret. If you get the full record of this attack...
Oh, I see. Well then there are two alarm bells that went off in my head. One that went off in my head, and that's another one. She's a robot.
You're holding out on me on alarm bells?
I was looking for something that was an alarm bell for Sarith, not for Empire.
Oh, gotcha.
But there's another one, is that Day's having sex with her. I don't think they want that to be public knowledge either, or knowledge of their enemies, certainly.
Yeah, I don't know who cares about that, though.
maybe a future wife.
Oh, well. I mean, she's not put off by the Gossamer Corp, but you fucking your android. This is where I draw the line. A sex bot, Cleon.
Yep. I don't know. It's his assistant, right? It's like her fucking Rue.
Mm.
Would she do that? I don't know.
I actually have no idea.
She might. Yeah,
they might. I was gonna say.
Every night. Who knows?
Uh-huh.
But we saw how he survived the attack. He's just a badass, and he's got a badass robot helping him. I mean, that's how you survive an attack by assassins. Yeah, you're just a badass.
Use your sex bot's head to block the fatal blow, and then... Oh, jeez. Yeah.
But I assume it will be a Scandal when that comes out. And then we move on to the final scene here, where Hober finally emerges from the vault. He tells Polly and Constant that Harry said he needs to take their ship on his mission. And before Hober leaves, Constant professes her attraction to him and her disappointment in not having had the chance to bed him. Which is kind of shocking to me. Because she's, you know, a brother, right? That's a surprising thing. They don't apparently have any limits on their sexuality. She has some personal proclivities, right? A woman of small opportunities and particular likes. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that line.
She only likes Hobers. That's her. She's the Hober only.
But
she got a bumper sticker. I stop for Hobers.
Jeez.
I don't know.
If you're Hober.
I will say this, brother. That's a particular taste. Hober Mallow is particular like.
I guess it makes a certain amount of sense if this is nothing more than a marketing arm. They probably wouldn't have rules you would expect of a monk or a priest
it's probably more like listen to the foundation, give them beneficial trade deals. It's not so much like don't put this body part in this other body part, especially if you're this other. I don't think they care much about that.
But it was surprising to me, and just the intensity of the attraction that she's feeling here was another surprising thing.
Did you get the idea that Hober is a slightly different guy towards her? I got this, like, a reluctance that I don't think is Hober Mallow to pursue a relationship with her. And I wonder if Harry, when he revealed where his blade would be pointed, somehow gave up that, you know, you're going to... The mission that you're on is going to lead to... And he's trying to maintain separation to kind of save himself.
It's interesting because his demeanor is very different here than the beginning of this episode when he's flirting with her actively, right?
And he's still flirting with her, but there's like a wet blanket over the whole thing, especially when you consider how strong she's coming after him, because he's like throwing like, oh, well, you're young and you've got morals and you've got... She's like, I'm not that young. I don't got that many morals. Kind of want to do it right now. He's just like, I do wonder if he knows where the blade's going to be pointed, and is pointed a little bit too close to weenus here.
That makes a lot of sense, I think. Weenus. Can we talk about weenus? Weenus is the all-time worst fictional name I have ever heard. Hands down.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a Friends reference.
A Friends? No, it's from the book. The first Foundation book. There's a major character named Weenus.
Oh, right. Yeah,
Asimov made this shit up.
That's funny. Is it a clue? Is there any kind of... Because like
the character's so different from Constant.
I almost always look up the character names that we hear to see, like, you know, what bells. But like I did all this cavalcade of names he's throwing out. I thought they're joking. Ween is like... I thought it was a Friends reference because there's something with Chandler where he makes fun of people in his job getting... obsessed with the weekly estimated net usage statistics, like these crazy people run around, where's the weenus, how's the weenus, I'm concerned with the weenus, and like at the end of this episode he's been promoted and he's like demand, like it's like 8 o'clock on a Friday night and he's like, damn it, where I've seen the weenus and I'm not happy. And it's like, but no, Asimov came up with weenus.
Yeah, he coined the name weenus apparently.
He's like, I like penises. Mm-hmm. What if I changed the first letter to a W.
Yeah. I will say it is an insult to be sure, because the weenus character is considered a fool and he I won't say anymore. He's a real dumbass, that guy.
Ass like a mule?
Oh, no, I don't know anything about the mule.
I don't think you got to the mule.
No, I definitely didn't.
So.
But I got to weenus.
We got to the weenus. Weenus is book one knowledge here. Mm-hmm. I thought there was a little bit something between them that was not between her and him, is between him and her. And I wonder if not Harry's mm-hmm. secret mission. He's giving her a little too much.
Yeah, we end the episode with another voiceover from Gale. With few exceptions, attraction is entirely irrelevant to human history. It only matters on the small scale of the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you feel like it. You feel, even though you've only known these characters for an episode, really, you start to feel like this is kind of a missed opportunity. This is tragic in a way that they're being sent off without ever having developed a relationship that could have been great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you've heard of any of podcasts for any length of time, I'm a notorious shipper. I was shipping these guys right away, but it's a sad ship because I think it's going to go down. I mean, this last thing is not what you say when the viewer is being introduced to a love affair that's going to last a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, attraction is completely irrelevant to human history. It only matters at a small scale to human art. That's not what you say when a grand romance is start to begin. That's like a slightly forlorn, melancholy statement. I could be wrong. And again, there's also the tantalizing possibility that Harry is spinning Hober up to do the opposite, mm-hmm. to reinforce the mission of peace. So who knows? We'll see. I cannot wait. I literally, as soon as we're done recording this, I'm going to watch the next episode because I've been holding out for like 4 weeks now.
Oh, that's right. You watched this ages ago.
Right.
I just watched it.
I sprinted to four, and then so like, yeah, I'm ready to get back onto the weekly grind because we'll be keeping
it. Nice.
We'll be 1 week ahead of you from the rest of the season. So for feedback purposes and going forward, there shouldn't be any worry about us accidentally spoiling anymore. So we made it. We made it.
We made it to the end of the episode too. How do you feel about
that? All right. I am pleased. If you would like to send feedback about Foundation, it's easy. Foundation@baldmove.com is how you do that thing.
You're listening to Foundation and Podcast. We'll be right back. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
And we're back. Respect and enjoy the podcast.
All right, here's the feedback for this week. First up is Lucas says, I think your point about the fleet's morale was interesting. Did the fleet ever have a strong esprit de corps? And when? I can't imagine it's been like this during the whole Cleonic dynasty. The same dude has been ruling over empire for generations. Why now are they on the verge of mutiny? The simple answer is the genetic drift that they have previously experienced, since he's now repaired, has made the difference. But that's boring. I know you guys are fans of The Wire, and I am too. I think it'd be much more interesting to say that even though it's been the same guy ruling in the same manner over 16 or whatever iterations, people are still beholden and enslaved to some extent by systems which they have no control over. That no one, no matter how powerful, can control all the systems, and it eventually becomes a beast all its own. It would also dovetail nicely with the whole concept of Harry's plan, which basically says that systems are what he predicts and not individual people. Under the exact same person in the exact same role will eventually result in things even under his purview changing significantly. If you can't tell, I'm not a fan of the implications of genetic drift thematically, even if it's kind of cool as its own isolated subplot. Jim, what do you think about this line of reasoning / criticism?
I mean, as it relates to like a mutinous military, I don't know. I feel like you'd get various levels of mutinous officers over the course of these generations, right? Because like the military is not changing its structure much, but the individuals within it are changing constantly, right? And that's the thing. You're going to have the Bells who are like disobeying an order here or there because they think it's the right thing to do. And then you're probably going to have commanders who would never have disobeyed an order no matter how much it seemed stupid or would have cost them. So it's probably just we're picking up in a particular time that is one that has a commander who is willing to disobey an order on that front. The larger question about, like, you know, can Empire hold on to all the planets? Is that even possible? Does that create a scenario that's so stifling that you get a rebellion that necessarily destroys it and, like, all the systems interacting? I mean, I think, yeah, that's one of the central reasons Empire is falling, right? Their reach has become too broad.
Yeah.
They can't succeeded accommodate. Yeah, they can't. It's not even that they can't accommodate everyone's wishes or whims. They just can't repress those, I guess. You know, because everybody's going to have different things they want, and not all of those are going to line up with what Empire wants. It's just a matter of like how much does that tide turn before it actually turns the tide, right? How much of that feeling of resentment can the Empire tolerate before it boils over and destroys itself?
Yeah, I agree. And it's like some of the things that Lucas is saying here, I feel like is like a fractal. Like if you're looking at a Mandelbrot pattern and you like zoom in it and it just looks the same. Like, I feel that's what you're doing. You're like, oh, I don't like this genetic drift because I think it should be just an outcourt going of the. But the reason the genetic drift is happening is not because they forgot to do how to do cloning correctly. It's because people infiltrated and fucked it up from the outside because they were being. Because the Emperor is being so heavy-handed and they're oppressing so many people. Like, right. You know, like an institution gets too big that you can effectively govern. Once that happens, you only can oppress, right? You can just try to suppress. And I feel like you're saying, like, when did they ever have a strong esprit de corps? I actually think in the early stages of the Cleonic Dynasty, things were pretty good for the Galactic Corps, at least. You know, like... In the frontiers of the galaxy, where they're taking more than they're giving back, and you know you've got the Empire part of the Empire happening, it probably sucks. But like at the core, where all the wealth and affluence is being collected at, I bet it's pretty nice. But like that's just not like oppression is not a stable state of governance, because eventually you have to spend so much money on the oppression that you're not even making the lives. The lives good for the people who are supposed to be on top, and you can no longer protect them from the people in the bottom just trying to survive. And so like I feel like it's not just the genetic drift, it's all of the things that's happening, and that's what Harry's point is. It's not just one thing would take the Empire out, it's going to be a slew. And if you would stop the genetic drift, if Cleon had stabilized and that had not been a problem, he would still have, you know, renegade generals and breakaway empires and people nipping at their heels.
Right?
Yeah. Because they can't, the bottom line is, if they could effectively govern, which means meeting the needs of the majority of the your people and making them feel they're represented, they wouldn't have any problems. So.
And ultimately, like, if you want to boil it down to its most essential elements, it's entropy, right? It's yes. trying to enforce order upon chaos, which is the definition of humanity in a lot of ways, that only works in its singular form or whatever form it's taking at the time to a certain point, and then it itself begins to decay, right? It's at the risk of promoting one of the podcasts here on the Ball Move Network, growth, decay, transformation. That is the inherent cycle in everything. And you can see, like, I bet during the period of expansionism for the Empire, actually the people on the Outer Rims probably felt, or on the outer edges of the Empire, probably felt pretty good about it. Everything was growing, right? Yeah. Like, they brought these machines
space elevator.
And they brought these machines, these giant machines in to start mining these outer planets. And there was so much wealth flowing to those planets.
Economic
and
development, baby.
Yeah, the people were really loving that. Until the point where the palladium dries up and they turn the machines on the people and the transformation has happened and the decay has started to set in, right? Like, that's like, you can take a sampling of any period of the Empire and say, what are we in? Are we in the growth stage? Are we in the decay stage? And right now, this particular lens we're viewing it through is the decay stage.
Nicole K says, I'm so thrilled for more Foundation. I respect and enjoy your coverage. Well, thank you, Nicole. Like you guys, I love the new characters we were introduced to this week. I especially like Rios, and I'm interested to see where storyline goes. However, I couldn't shake the uneasy feeling about Empire reuniting with his husband. Is anyone else worried that this might be too good to be true? Like, maybe the husband. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. Glaewyn?
Glaewyn, yeah. It sounds it really just
Glaewyn,
sounds
as I call it.
It sounds like Jerry Lewis should be saying it. Glaewyn. Yeah.
Glaewyn.
It's a bad name.
My lady. Yeah. Might not actually be his husband, but just some kind of clone or trick by the Empire. Or maybe it is his real husband, but he's been brainwashed and it's like true blue for the Empire and has been brought in to test and manipulate Rios. I hope I'm wrong, but I couldn't quite shake a double agent vibe I was picking up. Just wondered if anyone else did too, or if this is just a side effect of my recent Mission Impossible marathon. Oh my God. Who's going to rip off the Glaewyn mask and reveal it's been Demerzel all along? I mean, the Empire deserves this, right?
Deserves
Like the fact that we're all this skeptical, and I—that's what I said about Bel Rios. Is like, why is he walking into this obvious trap with his eyes wide open? And I thought they gave us a pretty good answer that he actually is a sucker for the people of the Imperium, and he wants to be a bulwark against the excesses and depredations of the Kleonic emperors, and that's very noble. But
sure,
what do you think the odds are that there's something up with Glaewyn? Like, as soon as Bel Rios achieves his mission, there's going to be a time bomb in his chest, or they only decanted a clone that has 9 months of cohesion to... What is going to be the rug pull for Rios, if any?
Yeah. 8 years with the Empire. Huh.
Because it seems to me like... Nah, I don't want to. Because, like... I'm worried that half-remembered memories from my 13-year-old are actually whispering into my ear, and I'm actually giving spoilers. So I'm just going to stay away. What do you think? There's an inevitable rug pull for Bel Rios?
It's possible. I think 8 years is a long time to be. I want to know more about the 8 years that Glaewyn spent, because I know where Bel was. I want to know what was happening with Glaewyn, because if he is kind of a captive of Empire and being like tortured and manipulated and shit, that could have a huge effect on him, and he could be, you know, some sleeper agent that's you know, sent to keep watch on Bel, and if things go wrong, either take over or report back, whatever. But
yeah,
we don't really have an insight into that, because I could also see 8 years, you know, just being a citizen separated from your spouse by the Empire could foster a lot of resentment. And yet he's content to step back into this role. So there can't be an overwhelming resentment there, or at least not as much resentment as there is affection for Bel. So I don't know. I want to know more about him, but yeah, there's a potential there. He could certainly be a plant for the Empire.
Yeah, I'm not sure like how much of a chance is of being a double agent, like, ha ha ha, you thought I loved you, I really love the Empire. I mean, that's but some kind of rug pull, like, you know, you think you've done your duty by the Empire, and he, but the Empire still wants you to know that you're his, you know, that you're his vassal, and he kills your husband just out of spite because he can't imagine.
Oh yeah,
he can't imagine ever need being in a position where he's going to need you again, or he's got you by the balls because you're ultimately loyal to the Empire and you also love the little people. So what are you going to do? I killed your husband. You're going to stop protecting the little people? Like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like something that this version of Day would do.
I think so. That's the thing. And I don't think that this version of Day would leave Bell to run his own operation here outside of his view, right?
That's
I think he does have a mechanism in there somewhere, and whether it's Glaywin or somebody else, it just hasn't been revealed yet.
Yeah, that's another good call. Like, you should suspect
he doesn't trust the guy, right?
Yeah, yeah. Why would he? Why would he? He's got to keep tabs on him. He's an enemy. Tom from South Jersey says, I know this is late, but I just watched the latest episode and I'm scratching my head trying to figure out why they would juxtapose such a comical and cartoonish scene with the rescue of Hobo Mallow and the seriousness of the touching scenes, the general returning to his husband and troops. I'm supposed to believe that a prison... Wait. I mean, I'm usually sensitive to tonal changes like that, but I don't know. Like, I felt like it was a serious situation with Hober Mallow. It's just that he, that the comedy is just how easily he can escape such a sheer death situation and just outsmart this fool. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I didn't see it as slapstick. It wasn't like Dumber Dumber against Philadelphia, the movie, you know, like, is more like,
yeah,
I don't know, a Wes Anderson film against Philadelphia, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, I'm totally cool with this. I think if you can pull it off, and there's definitely ways to mess it up, I think it could be done poorly. But I come back to Breaking Bad when I think of this tonal clash and it working really well, right? You got Jesse and his friends who are complete fuck-ups and idiots. And then you got the stakes of Walter and his family. And they're incredibly high emotional stakes. And in a single episode, they will do both of those things, and it works beautifully. In fact, it works so well that it's an essential part of the show that I love. It's the thing that I love about the show the most, is those two tonal differences.
The humor is improved by the tension.
And vice versa, yeah. And I think they're getting a good long way toward that in this show. Things like Titan's Prick, they don't feel out of place to me. They feel like they're adding to the texture of this show. I don't need it to all be serious, right? I do want some comedy in my shows because I like comedy. And if you can do it well, it really works. And I think they're doing it pretty well here, for me anyway.
Tom's got another substantive criticism. He says, I know I'm supposed to believe the prisoner can escape all those guards in a convertible skiff. I know they suffer from stormtrooper aim, but that was outrageous for a show that hasn't really shown a tone like this before. I don't know. Like, my idea of this planet is that they are a bunch of incompetent buffoons too, that are technologically inferior to the Foundation and by a good margin.
You're talking about Savannah? I don't know.
Is that the military? I couldn't remember. That's the where all the military guys were, but wherever the Generalissimo and his hot security chicks were, that, like, those guys seem like they're buffoons who are inferior technologically. This is a backwater planet by Imperial standards, and Foundation has, as of this episode we found out, better than Imperial tech. Like, they have surpassed Empire in terms of their warp technology, in terms of maybe their personal shielding technology. So I don't think that Hober Mallow was necessarily in mortal danger at any point in this time. And it is supposed to be kind of a romp. And I don't think he'd have that same success against Imperial stormtroopers. you know, the guys looking like Judge Dredd with the Stargate helmets. But these guys, it's like, yeah, it's like getting the, if you're a professional, if you're like a space alien that has shields and shit trying to get over a local redneck militia, you know?
Sure.
Like Don Johnson and Glorious Bastard style. Like, I don't have a problem with that happening at all. If he's able to make a fool out of the Klingons troops, that would be a different kettle of fish, I think.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, the action on the show doesn't always work as well as like that blend of humor and emotional stakes for me. The humor and the highbrow stuff kind of, they work better than the action most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Something they're getting better at and working on.
Yeah, but integrating it better.
It's not its forte, you know? The show's doing other things better for sure.
Jeff says, according to a study in the New Atlantic article, major personality changes happen before 30 years old and after 60 years old. He included this report on the study in the Atlantic. Apparently, that's true, that people experience profound or tend to experience profound personality changes when they're in their 30s and when they're in their 60s, which dovetails nicely with the thing they got, the genetic dynasty. Mm-hmm. So it's not sure if Apple planted a story, but it does seem to bolster the Empire's storytelling of the dawn, day, and dusk. I had thought that 30 and 60 cutoff lines were a bit conveniently arbitrary, justified by nothing more than 90 divided by 3. And 30 does feel a bit young to start chief monarch duties, and 60 does feel a bit early to semi-retire. But this new data at least shows these ages as significant inflection points of personality. Which also means the day period of 30 to 60 is the period of one of the periods of greatest personal stability, or might we say stagnation. You don't have to be scientifically accurate in your organization of a fake empire, but it doesn't hurt.
Sure. Yeah.
Guys, trying to remember, I saw something where it turns out the ancient people... Oh, the idea that the Arctic and Antarctic. Do you know that the words Arctic and Antarctic literally mean with bears and without bears?
Jesus.
Because the ancient Greeks like knew in the north that there was bears at that pole, and they deduced that the opposite side of the earth would be the opposite and it wouldn't have bears. And they were fucking right. Just for doodah luck.
What?
They happen to not have bears in Antarctica. So, wild. It works out that way sometimes. J.J. Johnson said, this episode felt a lot like late 70s, early 80s Star Wars movies. The ship escaping from underground while the stomping machines try to destroy it. Harbo Malo as Han Solo.
Yep, totally.
I'm going to go with Harbo Malo. The feel, the first time awe-inspiring scenes, even the terribly inaccurate shooting from the bad guys, all early Star Wars. This felt nothing like the foundation we've seen so far. It does make me feel like the kid I was when I saw Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, and makes me very happy and yet very worried for the show. Jim, should
nothing
JJ
like
should JJ be worried? Are you worried? Are you worried about these fantastic flights of fancy?
You're telling me you're worried because this show's action sequences have become more like some of the most beloved movies ever made.
Sci-fi action. Yeah.
I'm not worried. In fact, I think it's been an improvement from the season one action stuff.
Honestly, I think that people are in denial about how pulpy a lot of Asimov's work was, especially, I mean, okay, including Foundation. The series overall, and it's a total I mean, it was written in the heyday of that era. Mm-hmm. There is his fair share of atomic monsters and robot. I mean, it's you know, spaceman wearing silver there's a fair amount of Flash Gordon in Asimov, because that was just kind of like the time. So like, I don't, yeah, like the fact that Star Wars was hugely influenced by Foundation, and that the current Foundation version of Foundation is hugely influenced by Star Wars, I think that feels beautiful, natural, just, and right.
Yeah, I'm certainly not going to complain. I want them to do well with the action sequences, and yeah, say what you want about Stormtrooper shooting. It's kind of a joke in Star Wars too, but nobody lambast Star Wars for it, right? Nobody's like, fuck this stuff, it's terrible because the stormtroopers can't shoot.
Right. And to me, it's like, as long as they keep the cerebral side of the show up, this all stuff is bonus. Like, if it was all there, if it was like Isaac Asimov's foundation, it was just the pulpy Star Wars John Williams stuff, and they didn't have any of the intellectual side, like, I would not be very interested in the show because I've seen Star Wars, and it's, but like, this is, you know, Star Wars plus, if you want to say it that way. It's got a lot of this, some of the essential Star Trek kind of like societal commentary and, you know, gee whiz, what if wonder kind of big picture questions. And I imagine people will be nervous, especially if this is one of your beloved touchstone type of developmental science fiction franchises. But like, I'm kind of starting to relax. And also, if the show falls off and gets real dumb, I can always be like, okay, well, it's starting to suck. But
sure,
I'm not looking for problems, you know.
Yeah.
Zach says, after listening to you guys discuss whether or not the show has made direct connections to Earth's solar system at the end of your last podcast, I felt like chiming in to remind you guys that the show has given us a bit of an answer already. If you recall, a cold open from one of the later episodes of season one featured a young Salvor talking to her father, asking him where, quote unquote, we came from. Reminds her that he and her mom came over to Terminus on Harry's ship from Trantor, and Salvor corrects him and says, no, I don't mean like, where did the people of the Foundation come from? I mean, all the people. Where did humans come from? This puzzles him, and he thinks about it for a moment, making it clear that the answer to the question is not obvious. He lists a few in-universe theories about the origin of humanity and adds at the end, and of course, some people believe we all came from a place called Earth. He says Earth.
I didn't either.
From this, I think we can extrapolate that humanity in this universe likely did come from Earth, and that we are in the same universe as our reality, but so far in the future, the Earth is just a distant memory of the rearview mirror of humanity's collective history. Essentially, like the Battlestar Galactica analogy we're making. So far in the future, in fact, the coming from Earth seems like more of a folklore rumor than confirmed fact, and somehow got separated from grand story of humanity's journey at this later phase of intergalactic expansion. So does Demerzel keep a diagram of her solar system because she's older than we thought and actually once lived on Earth, keeping a diagram to remind her of a place that so long ago was called home? Or is she truly the age that the show tells us she is, but keeps a diagram of that solar system because being 11,000 years old, she's one of the only entities left with the knowledge that Earth is in fact the origin of everything modern society is?
Totally see that. I could see her being, you know, the Boston Dynamics, the thing we joked about. But like, there's a wrinkle in here in this latest episode where we see it on the wall, the Empire's art wall, right? Like, that to me says that it at some point had some meaning to the Empire, at least the symbology of it. And I don't know if that's because historically they've kept records and they know that they've been derived from Earth, although they don't talk about it. It's just kind of a history book sort of thing if you delve deep enough. Or if it just the imagery itself somehow survived the death of the civilization that would remember our beginnings on Earth. Their beginnings on Earth, I guess.
I could easily see that, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Like they're using the symbol, though they don't really understand its context.
Yeah. Or they see it as like, this is a myth. It's a popular myth, but it's, you know,
sure,
it's been so long that we just assume, you know,
it's like seeing a cross, you know, in some work of art.
Or like Garden of Eden. I think Garden of Eden is a perfect example of like, I don't think Garden of Eden is a literal place. I know that's controversial.
Same
to
here.
Some people don't really care. I don't think it's a real place, but I also am I don't like when people say Garden of Eden, I'm like, where? That's no place I've never heard of. I'm familiar with it because I'm, you know, I grew up in a civilization steeped in that myth. So,
but you know, thousands of years from now, will people still remember that myth, or is it going to be something that's so lost to the history of time that, you know, you could see a cross and not immediately associate it with the Christian mythology?
We got some time, so I'm gonna engage in indulgent little head scratcher by Zach. He says, if I could be missing something here, and it might be something as fundamental as the definitions of a robot versus an android in Isaac Asimov's extended universe, but shouldn't all sentient or self-directing technology that operates its own body be held to the laws of robotics? If so, why and how are the autonomous mining droids that chased and shot at Gale and Salvor and Harry at the end of the episode able to do so? Should protecting both humanity and the individual humans be a higher directive for them than extinguishing any or all life on Una's world as they seem programmed to do?
Well, unless they're programmed to ignore the laws. I mean, the laws are something that's programmed into robots, right? So you change the programming, you change the laws.
That's the thing. You got to remember, the number one, the rules of robotics are not really a thing in this series. I mean, they are, but sure, they can't make rules. I don't think they can actually explicitly cite the rules because they don't have access to that part of the robots part of Isaac Asimov's canon.
Right.
And then even in, like, I think there is a difference between, like, an automated mining droid that doesn't have a generalized artificial intelligence that could be reprogrammed to attack living things versus a thinking machine reasoning out that it should kill humans. Like, it's a fail-safe on a on a reasoning machine, so they can never exceed or enslave humanity, not, like, a technical limitation or
right, like a jump ship can still kill a bunch of humans by jumping, right?
Sure. And you could program to do so in an automated way, you know. But it wouldn't be the same as Dimmerzell deciding that, like, I need to send the ship as a bomb because it suits my agenda, blah blah blah. So to me, I think the show is doing a remarkable job of bringing all that in. If you are an Asimov fan, that, like, you can clearly see the rules of robotics and how it's affecting Dimmerzell and all that stuff. But also, if you are not a fan of that, I think you get all this stuff, you know, without them having to explain it and violate the copyright of Asimov's grandchildren, I guess.
Yeah, with Dimmerzell, it really only applies to the Empire, right? That's her only real concern.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that's exactly right. Okay, let us get to the last piece of feedback, which is Chris from Western Australia says, I think it'd be funny in later seasons if thousands of years of genetic drift is represented by a completely different set of actors used to play Dawn, Day, and Dusk. Personally, I like to see Will Poulter as Dawn, Jesse Plemons as Day, and Steve Buscemi as Dusk. Who would you and Jim's choices be? I don't know, but I really want Terry Crews' Day in full Camacho mode. You know, like the president from Idiocracy. Uh-huh. Like, that to me is some fucking that is some drift.
Oh yeah, love it.
What plants crave?
I want Willem Dafoe as Dusk.
That is a quality drifted Dusk. Yes, I like that. Can I suggest Will Wheaton for Dawn?
He's a bit old at this point.
I know, but that's even funnier. Well, yeah, yeah, sure, like he's a scuffed teenager, and he always will be. Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of who's a Finn Wolfhard.
Oh God, yes. Finn Wolfhard is Dawn.
Or Dawn, yeah. Or
really Terry
good
Crews
Dawn.
Is Day.
Just in full, like, I'm a shitty kid mode, you know?
Love it.
Fuck you, Grandpa. We're brothers. I thought we were the same person. Okay. Amazing. I think we did pretty good there.
I do want to know what the hell happens today between the Terry Crews and the Willem Dafoe phase.
Drift. You drift enough.
Yeah, but the genetic drift happens over generations, not over the span of one man's life.
Couple melanin telomeres.
Oh
shortened,
yeah, you just get the same stuff that they use on the wall, right? The art supplies they're using, those pigments.
He's gonna start doing
body
paint.
And he just experiments with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's what the show needs. It needs chroma pigmented blackface.
Jesus Christ.
With Terry Crews.
Oh, no.
Anyway, that's our feedback. Once again, foundation@baldmove.com is how you send us feedback each and every week. If you'd like to follow us and see what we're doing aside from Foundation, of course, we're in the middle of Justified, City Primeval. Very fun, very good season of Star Trek, Strange New Worlds. Like, if you're an old school Star Trek fan and have been disaffected by modern Trek, I highly encourage you to give Strange New Worlds a try. It is really making this old school Trekkie's heart sing. Trekker, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Almost showed revealed myself as a fucking poser. But you can follow, you can figure out what we're doing. We're on most social medias at Bald Move, with the exception of TikTok, which is Baldest Move. And then if you want to support us, keep what we're doing here doing an active part. We don't get consigned to the dustbin of history. Please support us. Support.baldmove.com. You get the satisfaction of supporting content you love and cool things like extra bonus content, including ad-free feeds. Support.baldmove.com. That's going to do it for this week. Until next week, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Respect and enjoy the podcast.